You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning at 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this. And a very good morning to you. Welcome along to OTB AM. And it is Thursday morning. There are two more days left in the week, and then the weekend comes, and with it brings another brilliant weekend of sport. However, there was a reasonable night last night where Sadio Mane scored one of the goals of the season.
Yeah, one of the finishes of the season. Goals of the season? Like, everything about it has to be encapsulated into that.
No,
why the finish is so brilliant is because the touch is so bad.
Why are you splitting hairs so?
Because it's a terrible first touch.
Ah, you're such an asshole. But I can't believe it.
It's a phenomenal finish.
One of the greatest things you're going to see in sport.
It's magic.
Not good enough.
I'm sorry.
The bit before it is useless.
Half of it is brilliant because
when did your soul die?
He recovers so well.
What was the precise moment that your soul died?
Well, as I say in South Park, gingers don't have souls, so I never had one in the first place.
Jesus.
It's a brilliant goal.
Yes.
It's a brilliant goal. It probably is.
It's a get out of your seat moment.
Yes.
If you haven't seen it, because I didn't see it live last night. If you haven't seen it, stop what you're doing, keep us on in the background, and go and have a look. We'll tweet a link. Will we?
So it's out of your out-of-your-seat moment, because you're out of your seat and you're like, the ball's in the box, one of our attackers is there, and then you're back down your seat. He's like, oh, he's miscontrolled it. He's a professional footballer, and the ball can't even stick to his foot. And then it's like, oh, wait, I'm out of my seat again, because he's after recovering from that situation. So it depends whether you're a positive person or a negative person.
Yeah, well, I guess we've just established what you are. The debate is over.
There has to be... That's why, like, when we were talking a couple of weeks ago about the 20th anniversary of that brilliant Ryan Giggs goal in 99, like, the brilliance of that goal was the entire movement. It's not just about the finish. You can't just judge a goal in isolation of the final touch. It has to be the entire thing.
The brilliance of that goal is because of the context of the season. They're down to 10 men. Dennis Bergkamp has missed a penalty. Peter Schmeichel saves it. It's an FA Cup semi-final against their greatest rivals.
And the context is also that he runs from
they're
like
in the midst of
a
the
mile
treble.
Away.
They don't do the treble if he doesn't do that. That's all very important. And that's like a goal that will last the ages, right? I don't know if Sadio Mane's goal is going to last the ages, but it's amazing.
It's a very good goal. Like, I'm not saying it's a bad goal. I'm just saying
put the stink
that,
on it now, Owen.
I'm just saying that it comes with a little asterisk that he's a professional footballer who didn't manage to make the ball stick to his feet.
No asterisk. I think it's actually the perfect encapsulation of who Sadio Mane is. He has within him the ability to miss a sitter. If he was through one-on-one in the same situation, I'm not sure he'd be able to score. But because of the enhanced level of difficulty, all of a sudden, he's actually more likely to score, and he does.
Fair point.
And so whatever happens now, Liverpool have managed to establish that they are a team and they're going to be around for the next couple of seasons. You hope that they can keep this group of players together. And this is a proper title race, because when we were talking about them choking, they bounced back and they put in one of their best performances of the season, one of their best results, a 5-0 home win, closed the difference in the goal difference, and put a bit of pressure on Man City, who were apparently not very good last night. We're going to talk with Nathan a little bit later on. He was at the game. He was stalking one of the West Ham players, but I'm not sure it came to anything in the end.
What do you call that, that pendulum thing where you have like the five balls and you pull one at the side and then the one goes at the other end and it just doesn't stop? That's what this Premier League title race kind of feels like. It's like, when will the pendulum stop swinging in terms of who's got the upper hand here? Because after last night, if you're judging it just on the isolation of those two performances last night, you say Liverpool are back in front again in terms of who's got Big Mo. Like, when it comes to the 28th of February, I can't remember being into a Premier League season as much.
No.
It's petered out so many times. But the Leicester season was phenomenal because it was Leicester who was leading the way and you always thought they might slip. But I think really looking at this and now looking at the top four race even as a secondary thing, it's going to be a fantastic conclusion to the Premier League season.
One of the big questions that was asked on the show last night is where would Celtic finish? Kevin Kilbane had this answer in the Premier League, obviously. If they were in the Premier League, where would Celtic finish?
Where would Celtic finish in the Premier League?
But Celtic in the Premier League right now, I think they'd be bottom three right now.
Would they?
Yeah, I think they would now.
And the outside said they'd be seventh or something.
No,
no chance of yourself.
No chance.
No, that squad.
No,
good
not
God,
the squad, no.
Try to tell him.
No.
I mean, like, what are the circumstances under which they get there? Is it with the current manager and squad with the same budget, or because they're in the Premier League, do they suddenly have the same budget as West Ham and Watford? And, you know, can they suddenly start paying players properly?
Well, I love the way Joe says, I knew it, when like an opinion is kind of taken directly as fact there. I do kind of come down on that side of things as well, though, that it would be a struggle, that they would kind of...
Do they get straight in, or do they have to go into the Championship and get promoted? So are they bouncing through after a season of And do they have the 60 million annual budget that everybody else has?
See, that is the question.
And so yes is the answer. They do, because they're in the Premier League, so they get the money.
Yeah, you're taking the... I think the question is, you're taking the current squad and you're dropping them into the start of this year's season with no more transfers allowed.
And which manager?
Brendan...
Neil Lennon.
Let's say, even if you give them Brendan Rodgers, I think the glass half full Celtic fan would say they're kind of a Leicester City, and the glass half empty fan would say they're more of a Southampton.
The glass half full fan says nothing of the sort. Owen, wash your mouth out with green and white striped soap. You traded immortality for mediocrity. Never a Celt, always a fraud, is the banner that was unfolded by, you know, that coterie of Celtic fans who think that now, after all the success that Brendan Rodgers brought them, he was always a fraud. I mean, come on! Like, this is a creepy ex-boyfriend territory.
he didn't do bad for a fraud, did he? Didn't do bad for someone who, an unbeaten season, a fraudulent unbeaten season? Is that what we're calling it now, from Brendan Rodgers' perspective? Like, I think that's fairly unappreciative from the Celtic fans there, isn't it? It's fairly clear that it was a better personal decision for Brendan Rodgers to go to Leicester City. Like, is he going to achieve as much when it comes to trophies and winning things with Leicester City? No. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's not a bigger job. So I think bad move. I disagree with pretty much all those Celtic fans there saying that Brendan Rodgers is a fraud.
It's Thursday morning. That means we've got the shot clock with Kieran Donaghy coming your way a little bit later on. One of the things that came up for discussion was the Kerry Tommy Walsh, and Kieran Donaghy, he's a fan. Have a look.
Great player, huge size. He's in serious, serious shape, physically wise. He had a tough the last 8 stages, but came out, won 3 big, massive kickouts. We got 3 points off them, showed massive leadership. Tommy left in 2009 as a youngster who I was looking after my first 2 years. He was in the corner next to me. He was my brother's best friend. I was kind of arm around him, always minding him. And he went to Australia. And he came back to us in 2015, and straight away inside in the dressing room, the way he spoke, the way he looked everybody in the eye, like, he just changed from this kind of young fella to this serious man who was a serious leader in that team in 15. And it didn't work out for him that time, and it might have been a bit too soon. He found his form with his club really very much so last year. Back in with Kerry, and absolutely, like, you know, he could be a serious weapon for Kerry come the summer.
Yeah, so good stuff from Kieran Donaghy on the shot clock, which is coming your way at around about 20 minutes time. Well, there's something's going on. Somebody's in the studio. Can we have a white shot, please? who's that? Whose body's that? Good morning, Tommy. There's a bit of stealth going on in the background. The producer can't work the TV. He's going to have to ring his younger brother and go, "Here, can you make the remote control work for me, please?
Don't go to the widescreen."
All right. We also have an interview coming up with Leo Cullen a little bit later on. Owen was out and met him yesterday. They were obviously launching a gala dinner for the 10th anniversary of the 2009 European Cup victory. So when is Rocky Elton coming back?
Good question.
I wonder. That would be, it's going to be interesting to see if Rocky makes it back. Anyway, here he is, Owen, yesterday, asking Leo Cullen about the future of Jack McGrath. Have a look.
You're going to have a familiar face coming up against you in Geordie Murphy. I guess the question that's been on everybody's lips today is, Jack McGrath going to be one of those familiar faces with him next season?
good question, yeah. reality is, like, yeah, there's, for whatever reason, like, some of the other provinces, I think, are, you know, looking at some of the players that we have here, you know, and so you can argue about the merits of what's right and what's wrong. You know, for us, you know, we were just trying to create a place here that players can be as successful as they possibly can. So in the group environment, but also as individuals. So if they produce the right behaviours, you know, they get picked and hopefully go on and get picked at the highest level as well, whether that's with Ireland or even beyond, you know, with the Lions as well. You know, you mentioned Jack has obviously gone on and done that. So there's always bits going on behind the scenes with the squad, and that's, you know, something that we don't tend to air in a public domain, out of respect for all the different people that are involved. But, you know, look, it's something it goes on. I think continue to go on. You know, I think it's a good reflection. When we have these questions, I think quite often it's a good reflection on, like, a lot of the good work that goes in the system here in terms of trying to produce players. And for us, that's, probably the thing that we can control.
Yeah, it's a tough situation for Leo Cullen. He's basically saying this happens all the time. It doesn't always lead to a deal, so it's just part of the normal conversations.
Yeah, and I think he's just trying to respect the private conversations that are going on at the moment.
So there's a bunch of other people who might be leaving too. Is that what he's saying?
Well, if you want to take it that way, for sure. Like, it's one of those situations that we read in the Irish Independent yesterday was very much in motion, and it seems like it depends how much you want to read between the lines here that Jack McGrath may be interested in leaving, that Leinster may want to keep him. But then again, Jack McGrath probably wants to there's probably a part of him that wants to stay at Leinster, that he's probably kind of considering the whole suite of options that he has at his disposal. Now, like, we don't know what's going on really behind the scenes here, but is there a situation where he's unhappy with his minutes, for example, this season? Is there a situation where he just wants to get on the pitch and just play week in, week out in the biggest European games that are going to be there for Ulster next year? Perhaps that's the case, and maybe he just feels that Keane Healy now has that jersey locked down at the moment, and that's not going to be an option for him at Leinster. As I say, that's just my view on this. Like, Leo Cullen there yesterday, kind of respecting the privacy of the whole situation, so not giving too much away.
Yeah, all right. Let's move on to the sports pages. We've told you what's coming up already. We're going to hear that interview in full with Leo Cullen. We have the Shot Clock with Kieran Donnelly, and Nathan is going to join us. He was at the Etihad last night for the Man City West Ham game, and so I'm going to take you through the newspaper headlines this morning first. I'm going to start with the Examiner. Pressure, what pressure? And it's Sadio Mane, the man of the moment. Liverpool hit Hornets for 5, but City stay stride for stride. They kind of stuttered a little bit. There was a bit of a stutter step for Man City last night. Nathan tweeting about it was saying that they could have won 5-0, but they didn't play well, and they did need a penalty from Aguero to win the game.
Yeah, I think it's a fairly sizable stutter that when you look at the performance that Liverpool put in, it feels a lot more significant than things actually suggested on the pitch last night. That have Liverpool finally got their swagger back is the question, and I think they might have done. I think Mo Salah has sort of personified that you know, you kind of look at his performance at the weekend, and I know you were saying this as well yesterday, that perhaps can you actually put him into that bracket as the very, very top end of footballers in the world? And like, would he be taking off Lionel Messi in a critical game in La Liga, for example, when it's at nil all? Probably not. So there was question marks about Mo Salah, and like, he showed a lot more energy last night, and like, I think Liverpool in general just a hell of a lot better than they have been. And like, just one quick mention for Trent Alexander-Arnold, whose delivery of the ball is absolutely out of this world. Like, we talk about Sadio Mane's moment of magic last night, but 3 assists from Trent Alexander-Arnold. I think he's one of the youngest players ever in the Premier League to record a hat-trick of assists. An unbelievable performance from him. And let's not forget that a little bit of their stutter last month came from...
Corresponded with it, yeah.
Yeah, it came from when he was out of the team, you know?
Yeah, OK. So there's two pages of match reports from the Times at the start of this, but this is this piece from Emmett Malone. So yesterday the new 10-year ticket deals were announced by the FAI, much more reasonable than the ticket deals which were launched at the I think just before the collapse the last time round, which landed them in so much financial difficulty. But Delaney, in fairness to him, has come out and said we've learned a lot of lessons, and so it seems like there will be decent value in those tickets. That's the background to having Robbie Keane, TC, and Mick McCarthy in photographs in most of the newspapers today. McCarthy struggling to recruit new talent is the headline on the Emmett Malone piece, and it's the front page of the Examiner was, there comes a time when if you want to play, pick up the phone, says Mick McCarthy. So is Mick McCarthy, you know, doing the right thing here? He's waiting for Patrick Bamford to ring him, and Patrick, it's at his instigation whether or not he gets to play for Ireland. It's not that he wants to play for Ireland or that he feels Irish or that he is Irish. It's that, like, you know, where will I go for lunch today? Will I have a salad? Will I have a sandwich? These things, not really that big a decision in my life, is it? Will I play international football or not? What do you think? Will I play? Should I play? I mean, those weekends where the international games are on, when we're in the Premier League next season, imagine having those off. Imagine being the only striker at Leeds who isn't away. Who's like, well, I'm just hanging out with the manager going, yeah, oh, look at that chance he missed playing for whoever it was, whoever they sign.
Going for lunch with Marcelo.
He wasn't very good, was he? Yeah. I'm having him round to your house, cooking for him, you know. Look at my kids, look. I need to play.
I'm going to stick my neck out here and say Mick McCarthy has never used Tinder, but he's getting ghosted by Patrick Bamford here pretty badly, so he might get a sense of what it's really like out there. It's a fairly demoralising situation for him if he really wants him, if he really wants him in the squad. Like, are we sure that...
get ghosted a lot.
Everybody's got ghosted here. It's kind of an occupational hazard of being a young person these days. But Mick McCarthy
is... How far along the process do you get
ghosted? Mick McCarthy is figuring out what it's like to get ghosted.
Straight away, like,
which is not a great thing. Well, I guess in Mick McCarthy's perspective, it is kind of a straight away thing. I'm sure the other party involved is aware of Mick McCarthy's interest.
Come on.
Not really, no.
So after a few dates kind of thing?
I haven't used that app in a long time.
But when you were getting ghosted?
It's not a great feeling.
And do you get ghosted straight away, or is it like after a meeting?
No, getting ghosted, you have to have...
Met and have something has started.
Or something would have had to have been said. Like, I'm not sure you actually have to meet. Like, has Mick McCarthy actually met Patrick Bamford?
That's a good question, Owen. You know, the old hoary truism about not asking a question you don't know the answer to. Remember that bit of advice that, you know... Let's hear what Mick McCarthy had to say when he was talking to Stephen Doyle about this.
Well, there was word that you were looking for the likes of Nathan Redmond, Patrick Bamford, these kind of players. Have you had any news on those two in particular?
Yeah, I've spoken to Nathan Redmond's agent. I've tried to get to meet him. That's never managed that.
What's the problem there?
Well, he got injured. He was out of the team. I think he's having a good season and he's played for England. I wonder if he's, you know, he's still harbouring desires to play there. Maybe. I don't know. I haven't had the conversation with him, so I'm kind of guessing myself. In terms of Patrick Bamford, I've spoken to him. I've tried to meet him on a number of occasions, and he's been injured, and then a game was cancelled that I was going to go and watch, and he wasn't involved. And so he's played. He scored last week. He played out the game last night. I'm waiting for him now. Tell me where and when. Yeah. You want to play... I'll come and meet and let's arrange it. That's my message now.
Yeah, because a lot of Irish supporters might think, well, these guys didn't declare in the last 5 to 10 years and now Ireland seems like just a fallback for them. Can you understand why supporters maybe would feel a bit uneasy about seeing players like that in the squad?
Yes, I can. But then I can go back to 1984 when, you know, players like me were coming over and playing with a Yorkshire accent, you know, except with an Irish dad, and every right to be playing. And there was a fair bit of resentment then, and then I remember qualifying for 88 and 90, and there was no resentment at all, just celebration. So I think we've got to get back to that. Let me tell you, I want players to play for Ireland who want to play. And I don't want blow-ins. I don't want people who just, you know, might want to play for somebody else. They've got to give me that, show me that desire that they want to play. Because ultimately they're not playing for me, they're playing for Ireland. I'll be gone at some stage and they may be playing for longer. But what I would say is about the players that joined in 84 and, you know, the lads that I played with and lots of us who were born in England, they were all very passionate about playing for Ireland and still are and still coming over here, and we had a huge success. It would be nice to get back to that success.
Yeah. Is he getting hammered the same way that the Declan Rice situation caused such uproar?
What do you mean? Mick McCarthy getting hammered or Patrick?
Yeah, like, so he's chasing these guys, right? And they don't, they're like, you know. What did Kev say?
What did Kev say about this?
Yeah, about the situation, yeah.
Well, like, I think if you put that situation in the context of the Declan Rice area, like, I don't know, I think the Declan Rice thing is vastly different.
Is it? Right? Like,
because
it's not
of the
really,
actual
right?
footballing context.
Because, well, so they don't really want to play for us, and they're getting the opportunity to play for us, and the problem with Declan Rice was that he took 3 caps from an Irishman, or whatever the line was, 4 caps. Mm. But these guys are going to be 10 caps, and then they'll get in the team and they'll play, and we'll be like, oh, so, I mean, are we just, we've just decided now we're playing the game the way we always did, and we're forgetting about Declan Rice, and we're going to play the game, and if we get our hearts broken again, shame on us. Is that it?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's an element of truth in what Mick McCarthy said there about resentment lessening after 88, 90, 94. Like, there has to be some sort of truth in that, doesn't there? Now, the thing is, the key difference about this is that on a footballing level, Patrick Bamford and Declan Rice are probably in two different planets altogether. Especially when you look at the potential that Declan Rice has. And also when you look at the differences of Declan Rice as an underage superstar in an Ireland jersey, kissing the Ireland badge, calling the Irish national anthem catchy. There is a vast array of differences there in the two situations.
He led us on.
He led us on completely. And he was allowing himself to lead us on to the point where, you know, he could have come off the bench against Moldova, but let's not bring that back up again.
Tribe hurlers add Donaghy personality to the coaching team. So this is news this morning that Micheál Donoghue has added Kieran Donaghy to his backroom team. So far, because of his basketball commitments, Donaghy's input has been minimal, limited to 2 visits to Galway, but Donoghue has plans to use him a little more as the season progresses. I've been in contact with him for a good while. It's something he will ultimately get into himself. I brought in different people at different times from outside the box, and when I was thinking about it, I thought of him. I'd met him a few times. He's somebody that commands massive respect and is recognised for what he's achieved, and his character and personality is something that can be grasped on straight away. So we obviously did this week's Shot Clock yesterday before we knew this news, but we did talk to him about the situation with the Cork Hurlers, where Dougie Howlett is part of the backroom team, and we'll play that for you in our Shot Clock in just a couple of minutes' time. So is that my papers for you? Racing Post. Beckett and dramatic call for a 3-day ARC boycott. A boycott of arena racing companies' meetings across 3 days next week is being planned as the row of prize money levels at the racecourse group escalated yesterday. So this was a bunch of trainers who didn't run races, run their horses at Lingfield last week. So they're calling for that to continue. Penhill ruled out a repeat bid for Stayers Hurdle, so horses are starting to make the cut or not for Cheltenham, because we're getting there really close. And I'll give you quickly the Irish news this morning. So McCann, positivity will pay. Tyrone's happy with momentum gained ahead of Cavan Clash. He says that they're about to unleash attacking hell on their opponents. It's been coming. They need to get it out there pretty quick. And then there's obviously Neil Lennon on the back of that last night, a 93rd minute winner for Celtic in a 2-1 win at Hearts. Or maybe it was Parkhead, actually. Of course it was Parkhead. McCarthy was curt with Rice. I mean, that was after he was being told, and he said, yeah, I sent him a text later on. And a high five for rampant Liverpool. Liverpool 5-0 winners against Watford last night. I did wonder, were we stupid thinking that Watford were going to give them a game? Because Watford recently got to the 40 points mark. Wolves recently got to the 40 points mark and promptly lost their next game. It's like there must be the mother of all parties when any of those teams reaches the 40 points mark, and you're like, we're going to take a couple of weeks off now, boss. Mm-hmm. 40 points. That's what you said at the start of the season. Bonuses kick in.
On the beach.
We're getting. Having a good time.
That year when Tony Pulis's, was it his West Brom side that reached the 40-point mark at the start of February? Like, that must have been the longest beach session of all time, a long 3 months. The back page of the Herald this morning is high five Reds. Hornets thrashing keeps Liverpool point clear and lifts goal difference. And you've also got Neil Lennon there as Celtic beat Hearts 2-1 last night. Vindicated reads the back of the Irish Daily Mail this morning. Sarri dumps Kepa, then Willie repels Tottenham. Is the headline there. And Fitzgerald to leave Reds after 20 years, says Hugh Farrelly. So after nearly 2 decades in the job, Gareth Fitzgerald is believed to be moving on from his role as Munster CEO and will carry the legacy of overseeing the province's highly successful transition from amateur to professional rugby. So Munster's head of finance, Philip Quinn, who has served as acting chief executive while Fitzgerald recuperated from surgery, is understood to be a front runner to take over full time when the position becomes available, and it will become available later this year. I will go through some of the tabloids. The UK ones are going to appear on screen. At the back page of The Sun is Kepa, Cam and Sarri on. Keeper axed as Chelsea boss sends message. Gamble pays off with Pedro leading the charge. While the star goes with the heel deal. At Sadio Mane's goal last night, Ben Foster completely perplexed as that ball hopped over him. And pick up the phone if you want to play as well on the Irish version of the star there, says Mick McCarthy.
Yeah, that's the English star that we've got there.
The Mirror there. Is one heel of a goal.
A different newspaper.
Stunning Mane finish silences critics who questioned Red's title race bottle. While the Daily Telegraph then this morning goes with red hot Van Dijk. Captain scores twice as Liverpool run riot to maintain 1 point lead at the top of the Premier League. And they go with Chelsea on the back of the Guardian. It's Pedro and Eden Hazard there. No Kepa, no problem.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't talk about this yet. Spursy. Very Spursy.
Spurs are closer to sixth place now than they are to second place. Wouldn't it be
3 weeks?
Like, I just want to say that sound you're hearing right now is my heart breaking at the possible parachuting of Spurs right down the table to the point where, like, to potential fifth place. I would be really, really disappointed for everybody involved at Tottenham Hotspur Football Club. Not a single shot on target last night for the first time in a long, long time. Harry Kane starting to perhaps lose the rag a little bit. Is it surprising that, you know, that comes 12 hours after we saw in the newspapers yesterday morning their manager slaughtering them, really, in the press, saying it'll be 5 to 10 years with this attitude to win a Premier League? And really, it would be a marvellous bottle job for them to fall out of the top four at this point.
Is it because Pochettino was linked with the job? Is that the thing that they're like, well, screw it, you're leaving, you get to treble your wages to go to Man United, I want to go to Man United. Is that what happens?
Potentially. Like, it turns, like as I said there, like it turns the rest of the season into a fascinating spectacle. Like, this Saturday, the North London Derby suddenly has a lot more weight in it. Arsenal win, and it's a one-point gap between them, despite the fact that the narrative all season has been, is Unai Emery just, you know, a Severus Snape-looking Arsene Wenger, and Maurizio Pochettino is the greatest manager in the world. So it really would be hilarious. I'm just going to say it would be absolutely hilarious if Arsenal finished above Spurs.
We'll come back to football a little bit later on with Nathan. Now, though, we are bringing you episode 3 of The Shot Clock with Kieran Donaghy. Before that, though, here's Mick McCarthy about how he plans to use Seamus Coleman and Matt Doherty at the same time for Ireland.
The interesting thing is you've got a similar problem to Alex McLeish, Scotland manager. Two of your best players playing the same position, right back. Mm. He's got two left backs in Kieran Tierney and Andy Robertson. He's played at three at the back with Andy Robertson as a left wing back and Kieran Tierney as the left man on the three. Is that something you could do with Seamus Coleman and Matt Doherty? Do you have to get those two players into your team?
It's something I could do. Yeah, I think the Doc could certainly play a right-sided centre-back in a three and allow Seamus to be the wing-back. But then you might say, well, Doc's having the more a better role in terms of wing-back, so could I flip it round? Yeah, I guess I could. Am I likely to? No, I'm not. How do I shoehorn both of them into the team if they're both right-backs? Probably won't. How do I solve the conundrum? I pick one. The other one doesn't play and I come into the press conference and talk about the one who's not playing. That's what'll happen.
Do you think Seamus Coleman's form has been below average this season?
No, I don't. Whenever I've seen him play, I think he's played really well. He had a horrendous injury and he's got over that. He's back playing. He played last night. It's the derby on at the weekend. Is it Saturday? Sunday it is, I think. So I'm hopeful he's going to play in that. I think he's the best right back that they've got, but then it's not for me to pick somebody else's team. I'm slightly biased. I think he's a top player. I think he's a really good captain because of how he is. He's a role model, I think, for other pro footballers, how he's got to where he is, how he's maintained his standards, and how when he comes in the team now he plays just as well as he ever done. But he's got competition with Matt Doherty.
Will he keep the armband for you?
I haven't got a captain yet, I haven't got a team. But, equally, as I've just said, if I'm to pick him and he plays and I want him to be captain, he'll be everything that I desire in a right back and a captain because he's, as I just said, he's a role model, I think, for pro footballers.
All right, you're very welcome along to the Shot Clock, where we take aim at the biggest stories in sport. The rules are pretty simple. We get 8 talking points, 2 minutes each, and at the end of it, we try and keep score. Or maybe we don't. Kieran Donaghy is here. The rules are fairly simple. We understand them, right?
Yeah, we do, yeah.
There's a basketball hooter at the end of this, and you're supposed to shut up, but we'll see if we've met
it. If I can keep you quiet.
Exactly. We'll see if we've done it. So we're going to start with the first one. Ready, steady, go. Praise makes you weak. This was something that Billy Vinopola said to our reporter in the aftermath of the Ireland-England game.
It's the best thing about it is that We stay grounded, keep improving, and hopefully we can put out a similar performance to what we did. You know, in the week about praise making you weak, which is why I keep saying it's very, very important that we stay grounded.
Stay grounded, all right, as they absolutely pummel Ireland. Praise does make you weak, and this is a point that the Real Madrid fans know and the Kerry fans know better than any other fan base in the world. If you go to Real Madrid and you lose 2 or 3 games in a row, immediately the white hankies come out and they start whistling you, irrespective of whether or not you're Cristiano Ronaldo with all your Champions League in your back pocket or whoever you are. That's what happens. It's the same in Kerry, the roughest type of fucking animals. That's what Potty said, and he was right. And that's why Kerry win everything all the time. The Mayo fans, they love their team through thick and thin and thin and thin. And the Liverpool fans, they love their team through thin and thinner. Which is the correct way here? It's the praise. It's the overburdened love. It's the maternal instinct. You want a hard dad. You want some tiger parenting like you guys got from the Kerry fans. Praise makes you weak.
Yeah, it does. There's no doubt about it. We talked about it last week. I always wondered about that, you know, that you know, if we ever came back after losing in All-Ireland, absolutely, we get it in the neck. That's the way it is in Kerry. You get the praise too when you win it, but you're as close to a pat in the back as a kick up in the arse in Kerry. But, you know, other counties, you see them, they lose, they come back, they're still, you know, the welcome is big. Even their fans turn up in bigger numbers the year after, they keep coming back again. So it is a huge thing. And, you know, speaking of the English rugby team, you know, they go out and lose to Wales at the weekend. So it's trying to keep yourself on that level playing field and try and keep yourself as an athlete right in the middle where no matter what the results are going, that you're not getting too high or too low on yourself, because
England were the best team in the world according to the English media in the aftermath of their two excellent performances. You know, they killed us, fair enough, but it turns out we're not playing very well.
Yeah, no, exactly. And like, you know, I wouldn't be worried if Ireland play England down the road, and you know, we're not where we're supposed to be yet. And I think that's no harm along with the Irish rugby. I think, you know, I heard Johnny Sexton saying, look, we're trying to work on a few things. I never minded that when I was in with Kerry, when you weren't flying all year. You know, when there was a bit of a rough patch, it's no harm. It keeps everybody level, and it keeps you trying and working really hard to get there. So that's what Ireland will be hoping to do.
I think Billy Vanapola is right, and we should all channel our inner Real Madrid fan.
Yeah, next up, Doug Howlett seen on the sideline for the Cork Hurlers last weekend, getting involved in a high-performance role. I think it's a great move by Cork, but some people don't.
Is it a bit of a cut after that? Is it really going to change how you are from one day to the next based on a conversation with someone who was successful in a professional sport?
Yeah, and you know how hurling people are a little different as well, and can see through, how should we say, see through, not bluffers or anything like that, but he can't give them advice about hurling.
That's possibly the most snobbish thing we've ever
had. Yeah, could well be, but they can't give them any technical advice, and hurling is such a technical game. I just imagine it would be things to do with their lifestyle, maybe goal setting, maybe he's doing a bit of psychology as well. You wouldn't know. I'd say it's just kind of being the best you can be, would say, off the pitch. A lot of those kind of things tend to, successful people tend to say the same thing.
Like, for me, having Doug Howlett involved, I always loved it. We'd often go to training camps, we get Paul O'Connell to come into his Ron O'Gara. Players talking to you that have been there at the very highest level, and we can consider ourselves at a high level in the GAA, but getting somebody in from a level that's even higher is and a professional level and a background, I used to love picking their brains. You know, I think we're quite ignorant to think that we can't learn off other sports. I've seen firsthand, being involved at a high level in basketball, bringing some of that stuff to the football team and how it could help both a club or county. So I think there's always stuff to learn, and the high performance is one thing, but I'm sure Doug will spot things. Like, he's in Ireland a good few years, he's watched games. I'm sure he'll spot things that he might just be able to tweak a player on how he goes for a ball or what he sees.
Two things. The lads are putting the knob in hurling snob, and John Myler has like got personal experience from his son of watching high performance over a long period of time. So he knows the value that you can have from a professional environment and the little bits that you can steal from that. So of course, if he thinks somebody like Doug Howlett can come in and just have a quiet word with three or four people and just get three or four people to be leaders and to be better leaders, then that transforms the culture of the team really quickly.
Yeah, and like an all-time all-black try scorer coming in, like that's as good as you're going to get from a guy that's going to give a young fella a nugget of information on how to get ready for a big game, or might spot a guy being tense, or might spot a guy being off the ball and spot a guy being too relaxed before a game. And you know, it's the team environment is crucial, and I think the All Blacks epitomise team environments. So, you know, Cork beat Limerick the weekend. You know, they have a lot of good hurlers. They're there, thereabouts. We don't know what way the hurling is going to go. There's six or seven teams out there that can realistically challenge for an All-Ireland. So, you know, John Myler is doing a great job by looking for every little inch and seeing what he can pull from another sport that might help them out and try and get Cork to the promised land, because the football isn't going too good for them. So hurling has to be big on the agenda.
We'll get to the footballers in a little while. So our next point here is Mayo. I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so last week that there was no way that Mayo, who have one of the best kick-out strategies in the country, were going to reveal their hand this early on in the season. It makes no sense for Mayo to come up to Croke Park and to do all the things that they're going to do later on in the year. Why the hell would you give this Dublin team and their massive backroom team the opportunity to get some tape at this stage of the year? Sure, a lot of the best Mayo players were playing and didn't have their best ever games in Croke Park. But do we really need to see Aidan O'Shea and Andy Moran and Boyle and Keegan playing their best football at this time of the year? No, we don't. We need Mayo to make sure that those players get some football into their legs, get a bit of fitness, and start realising what it is that the challenge that they face is. Everybody thinks I'm talking nonsense here, that Mayo had to come and beat the Dubs and put it up to them.
Of course they did. Like, what can you hide? Oh, we're going to push up in the kickout. They've been pushing up on kickouts for years. Dublin know how to counteract that. What tactic are Mayo going to do now that they're not going to do in the summer? There's not much to it. You have to go for the juggler. You have a chance to get to a league final. You have a chance to put another bit of doubt, just plant that seed of doubt in Dublin's heads that there might be just wavering a small bit and that hunger mightn't be there and that everybody else is starved out of their mind for this All-Ireland that's going to come up in the summer. A chance, a really good chance, and just disappointed because I thought Mayo were moving really well, and I've been a part of dressing rooms for 14 years in football, and I've never once gone out with a Kerry jersey on my back and said, "Oh, we won."
No, I'm not saying that either. I'm not saying that they went there. I'm not saying that they threw that game or anything.
No, I know.
If you're the management, are you actually really going to start saying, "Well, look, you guys beat them in the league final in Croke Park. Is that the last time they lost a game in Croker?
Yeah.
Didn't do you any good that summer in the championship, did it?
No, we didn't even get a crack at them.
There you go. So I just think that if you're going to beat them once. Wait until it matters.
Yeah, I would have liked to have got a crack at them later on that year, though, because, you know, some of the stuff that we did, and they would, of course, countered it, but we learned from that game, too. You know, you have to learn from both winning and losing. You always learn more from losing, but you learn stuff from winning as well, and if you beat a team and certain stuff has worked, you can certainly look to go at it again. So, yeah, I thought they missed a big chance to really stake a claim on.
Lulling them into a false sense of security.
Maybe. You might be proved right later on in the summer.
They're going to get cocky thinking, should we have the measure of these
guys? I hope we don't have to come back to this VT and be proved wrong. Zion Williamson, college superstar with Duke University. The most explosive basketballer to ever come out of college. All the shoe companies will be looking for this guy. He's the next LeBron. He's the next Michael Jordan. A freak of nature. Happens to blow out his shoe in the biggest game in college basketball that was on last Wednesday week. Sock came straight out of the shoe. Nike would be disgusted. I'd say Reebok and Adidas and Under Armour are probably having a party looking at that. This kid is the future, and Duke are in a bit of trouble with him now, and a lot of NBA guys have come out since and kind of said, you know, if you're that good and you're kind of ready for the NBA, just don't go to college for a year, yeah, because there's an 18, 19 year old rule in there now where kids like Kobe and LeBron that went straight from high school into the NBA, they don't want that anymore. They want this. That's why you see so many of these college players having a one and done where they go for 1 year and then go straight into the NBA. A lot of the top guys now have come out and said, don't go to college at all because you're risking an injury. If you blow out your knee, all of a sudden your draft pick goes down, you mightn't be able to come back from it, a bad injury, an Achilles rupture, or anything like that. So it's a really tricky one. And, you know, for these college guys, like, they're superstars. You know, when we were playing football with Kerry 2006, 2007 in All-Ireland Finals, our Americans used to come over at the start of the Garvey's Tigers years, and our guys used to be in there, and I'd say, oh, we've got a game in Dublin on Saturday, do you want to come up? Oh yeah, or Sunday, do you want to come up? And these guys land on and they kind of come away going, you know,
it was a big game.
What are you getting paid? Yeah, it's an All-Ireland final, there's 90,000 there, there's the erasmus. What are you guys getting paid? Oh, we're not getting paid at all. And it's very like that for the college guys. So they're kind of risking a lot for nothing.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a big debate at the moment. Should these top high school players just wait a year?
Yeah, or start getting paid. That's the solution here. And there's loads of money sloshing around. They could all be getting paid a decent amount.
Yeah, exactly. They're getting their scholarships and they're getting that. And then, you know, you can't pay every collegiate athlete. So there is definitely a, you know, but I think the guys that are bringing money into certain schools, like the tickets for this game were going for $2,500 Super Bowl prices for tickets for a college game in Duke last Wednesday. So, like, the money they're bringing to the college, there has to be a way to look at getting, maybe spreading it out to them.
All right, next one is Motion 39, the Dubs at Croker. What the hell is going on? Why can we not just have a competition that's fair from the start of the year, that everybody knows the rules? We're all going to have exactly the same situation. It makes no sense. The whole notion that there was this opportunity for Congress to have a vote, and because they didn't like the wording of it, they just throw it out. It's absolutely ludicrous. It means that this year, Dublin are going to have a massive advantage. We know that home advantage in all sports matters. It particularly matters in GAA against the Dubs because they play their league games there. And we've seen already in the league, they've lost two away games, they've won their two home games. It's not a coincidence. Being at home matters in sport. And the GAA had the opportunity to make the competition their biggest, most important competition the one that drives all the revenue, that inspires all the kids to go and play. They had the opportunity to fix it and they didn't take it, and shame on them for doing it. I've got nothing else to say about this. It makes no sense.
Yeah, it makes no sense. And I think it kind of was almost maybe brought up wrong. I think you were never going to get their home games taken out of Croke Park. But what should have happened, I feel, is that the neutral venue games should not be in Croke Park. That means Dublin would have Croke Park as their home game, which is their home venue. Let's face it, we can say Parnell Park all we want. Croke Park is the home venue for the Dubs. They'd have an away game, and their neutral game should be in a neutral venue. And I think it's taken the spot, it's taken the, what it's like to play in Croke Park is special, and to be playing there every second week and in qualifiers and quarterfinals is a bit much. That's the game we played in the Gaelic grounds, and All-Ireland semi-final taken out of Croke Park. We played in Croke Park with 60,000 the week before. It was a good atmosphere, it was a good buzz, it was a good game, it finished level, there was a lot of drama, but nothing like the replay. 50,000 crammed into the Gaelic grounds, people getting in all sorts of ways. You couldn't beat that for an atmosphere. Kerry in Dublin in Semple Stadium back in 2001, the Morris Fitz Pint. You know, bring the flasks of tea, bring the sandwiches, everybody get to a neutral venue that you get 30,000 or 40,000
into. What's the difference between in a small neutral venue or small provincial venue versus a half-full Croke Park?
A half-full Croke Park, there's nothing worse. A third-full Croke Park is as dead as you can be. 30,000 in Croke Park versus 30,000 in a Nolan Park or, you know, one of these stadiums is just no comparison. It'd be great for the revenue in the communities. It'd be great to bring big football games to areas that mightn't see football games. We're trying to promote football in some hurling counties. Bring it down there. Bring both teams an hour and a half away. If people don't want to go an hour and a half away to see a big game between two very good sides, that's their tough. But I would certainly look at bringing all neutral games out of Croke Park. Leave Dublin have their home games there, leave them go for their away games, and the neutral venue games in between grounds, it'd be way better.
The worst part about this is that Croke Park knew that there was an issue with this. They knew that the wording that Donegal proposed wasn't going to get forward, and they did nothing about it. They could have intervened at any point along the way and they didn't, so they decided to let the whole situation roll over again. Let's get another year of games in Croke Park, and the games in Croker were no good last year.
That's exactly right. How have they have not learned from the games in Croker last year? They were all dead ducks, like no atmosphere, no buzz, and we're on about building the super rates like it's going to save the football, and then they bring it all to Croke Park where there's nobody there to see it and it's just dead. So yeah,
we like referees and umpires in the show.
We do, yeah, and we're talking about umpires. Certain umpires are making huge efforts in their right to get to the good position to make the right call, and we normally give out sometimes about refs and umpires, but we felt we had to give them some praise. Here we have the Crokes game, and you can see this umpire trying to get to the right angle to see if the ball is going over the bar. And yeah, some people laughed. I was actually sitting at home with my wife Hillary, and I said, fair play to him, got to the right position to make the right call. It would have been far easier for him to stand at the post like some of them do and not get the right call and miss it. And then obviously we had the incident with Tom O'Kane, the umpire during the Dublin Mayo game, and he got
Polaxed.
Yeah, he got polaxed. But again, was in the right area, and yeah, Tom was okay. And to see him being stretchered off was obviously a worrying sight here, because players at this level going at that speed, coming at anybody that would be standing there would be a scary one. But Tom was on the mend, and yeah, good to see him up and about again. But yeah, just to give him credit to. For being brave, taking a hit, there's Tom's grand. So, although he looks still a small bit weary in that photo, I'd say the bit of food and maybe a pint that night might have settled him down. But in fairness, we do give out sometimes. But I thought it was good on both counts.
Do you have a good relationship with the umpires when you're in full forward?
Like that, like both. You'd always go in and shake hands with them beforehand, and you know there'd be times you'd be turning around, especially. As a big full forward, any big fall forwards, Michael Murphy, Aidan O'Shea, Tommy Welch, they all tell you that we get a bit more attention than smaller guys do. And there's the human nature, the aspect is, he's big enough, he'll look after himself. But like, you know, if you're getting pulled and dragged, you'd turn around. But I always found it better to try and talk to them. But of course, there's times you snap at them too. But I had a very good umpire, I put it in my book, a guy called Dee Butcher, and I went to him before a game, and the fullback was giving me rabbit punches non-stop for the first 10 minutes. And I went into Dee, who was the Stacks umpire, and there was the Tarbert umpire, and say, hey, what's calling the ref there? Like, the punch I'm getting is unreal. And Dee says, the next time you punch, swing your elbow as hard as you can. And I'll say, I saw nothing. And so yeah, I got punched, swung the elbow down, your man went, and there was pandemonium broke out, and the two umpires fighting behind the goals arguing. But yeah, so if there are umpires on your side, you've got a chance.
And you didn't get sent off, did you?
No. Dee said he didn't see anything. Perfect. There was a bit of boat in it. Yeah, 50-50, yeah.
One of the best stories from the last week has been the success of UCC in hurling and football. Not only do they have the best jersey, but it turns out now they've got the best teams in Sigerson and Fitzgibbon. One of the best stories of the Fitzgibbon Cup is Shane Conway, who is a Kerry hurler, who was one of the stars of the UCC team.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, you know, I talked to a few people about him over the last few days. I saw him at the county final last year. Absolutely unbelievable hurler. He had 14 points in the county final last year. You know, he got all the scores in the second half playing into Gael, like, and he was as brave as a lion for the size of him. And yeah, no, it was a great story, and great to see Kerry hurling in the spotlight because they do a lot of good work down there. And Shane is obviously our star hurler down there, and yeah, we're delighted to have him on to talk about that Fitzgibbon Cup. And I suppose, Shane, what it felt like to actually win that medal, and for you, your family, and your club.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was just kind of a relief in mountains because there was a lot of hype this year. We got to the league final, lost to DCU, and it was just a lot of hype going around saying that, oh, there's a great team here and they could win it. And then we played DCU in the semi-final, and it went to extra time, and it was a last-minute goal by one of our lads that snuck it in the finish. So the pressure for the Mary Eye game was, can we get our heads right and not to be listening around. So it was great that we did it, and there was a big gang, I think, from Alexander. They took a bus up. I think there was about 30-odd people there, so it was a bit more special that they were all there to see it.
That's class. Tell us a little bit about Lixnaw. So Galvin would have hurled for Lixnaw, with you guys as well?
Yeah, he did. He played. No, I never played hurling with him. I was too young, but I can remember him playing in 2014, and they won the county final that year as well. And he was a very good hurler, but he decided that he'd pick football, and he made a good name for himself as he did out of it.
Hi, speaking about football, you're tasty footballer yourself. We were in with Tommy Griffin and Peter Keane with the under 20s. Is it something that you'd ever consider?
I know.
I'm speaking with my football hat now.
I didn't even really think about it, really, but yeah, I was in there for a small bit, all right, and my plan away is still with Fnug, and we're trying to get things going again there. We're kind of on a downhill at the moment, but hopefully we can bring it back open. But no, at the moment I'm very happy playing my hurling, and sure, we'll see what happens down the road. Who knows?
What was the crack like Tuesday night in Cardins?
we had a crack, all right. We all went down to the Knaer to the home place, and we got I think 26 fellas to go down, so they had a small bit of a shock to see that many people coming through the doors. But God, we were well behaved.
Nah, fair play. I think that's a nice touch from the team, and I suppose talking to Paul and his brother about you the last number of days, you know, you're held in very high esteem. I think one of them almost referenced that they'd that there were 14 minders minding you around the place there last year in the county final, that you were the go-to guy, obviously, but that you're, the way you play, you're brave, you go for everything, you take your man on, and I think, you know, if you get a bit of rough treatment in Kerry, I think you've probably a few fellas to jump in and look out for you in Lixnaw.
Yeah, definitely. The older players, they look after all, not just me, now, but all. We have a few young fellas that are after coming on there, maybe a year below me. And like you said, all the older fellas, if you're getting a nasty doing or anything like that,
which can happen in Kerry and Ireland, yeah,
they're very quick to jump in if one in, all in. So no, they're very good like that, in fairness, to look after us. We'll just have to try and look after myself. No, it's always as well. We'll have to get a bit stronger or something.
No bother, but I hit the gym.
Shane, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Congratulations, man.
Hi, one second, Shane. Shane, I heard there's a doctor down in Lixnaw that might have two Sigerson Cup medals. So you're going to have to go get another one next year.
I'll have to try and get another one. Yeah, I met him below Tuesday after the bring down.
He wasn't long taking your taking your thunder.
He had to do him in his pocket to show me, so I'll have to catch him.
Yeah, all right. Bye. Best luck next year, and best luck for the rest of the season with Kerry going forward.
Cheers, thanks very much.
See, that's what I mean. That's exactly what happens. It's only in Kerry that you come home with a Fitzgibbon and be like, oh yeah, I'm the only one who's not even in a first division team. And it's like, oh, I've got two.
Yeah, he was taken down straight away. There's a doctor out there, Maris Fahey, who won two Sigersons like 40 or 50 years ago. And yeah, not bad. But Shane couldn't even get 3 or 4 hours in this. That's Kerry for you. You're a few hours in the spotlight, and it's, yeah. What, you got to get another one next year.
Praise makes you weak. Okay, we've got just 2 minutes left to make our big predictions for the weekend. I think you'll remember that I predicted accurately that Ireland would win a close game and only score 4 tries. What did you want?
I said six tries. Yeah.
Hey, just remember, just in case, you know, the internet never lies. I don't remember the rest of my predictions though.
Yeah. I was about to say. Okay, we'll come back to that.
I think Man United are going to win. Clare against Meath. We're going to talk about that. But I want to predict that Tommy Walsh is going to start and star at full forward again. You know, long line of good full forwards in Kerry football. What do you make of this one?
Yeah, I'm impressed with Tommy in his 2 games so far. Great player, huge size. He's in serious shape, physically wise. He had a tough the last 8 stages, but came out, won 3 big massive kickouts. We got 3 points off them, showed massive leadership. Tommy left in 2009 as a youngster who I was looking after my first 2 years. He was in the corner next to me. He was my brother's best friend. I was kind of arm around him, always minding him. And he went to Australia and he came back to us in 2015. And straight away inside in the dressing room, the way he spoke, the way he looked everybody in the eye, like he just changed from this kind of young fella to this serious man who was a serious leader in that team in 15. And it didn't work out for him that time, and it might have been a bit too soon. He found his form with his club really very much so last year. Back in with Kerry, and absolutely, like, you know, he could be a serious weapon for Kerry come the summer. Whether he starts or comes on is a big thing. I think he could actually be probably more dangerous coming on when one of our inside forwards has softened the guy up and tired someone out for 50 minutes. And I think Tommy's size and power could overturn somebody late on.
If the offensive mark comes in for championship next year, he's also at that point.
He's huge, and he won 2 or 3 of them the last day against Galway, leading out in front, like not necessarily the traditional high mark, but he's so good at getting out in front of people. And once he gets in front of you and gets a yard, you actually can't get around him. And he's so strong upper body that once he puts his hand out, he's grabbing the ball every time. So, look, he's gonna have a big say in how Kerry do this summer, no doubt.
We're nearly out of time, but I want to do this one. Do Kerry need Cork the way Celtic need Rangers in football?
Yeah, they do. And look. As much as I've gone to war and gone at it with Cork fellas over the years, I actually don't want to see them where they are at the moment. Like, you know, Tipperary can bury the hatchet on them Saturday night. And
pretty much.
Yeah, look at putting them down to Division 3, which would be, you know, very tough. And, you know, it just makes Munster weaker, you know. That was always the game for me, you know. I always said that.
I don't believe a word of this. You're delighted. You can't.
No, honest to God, I'm not. Honest to God, I'm not. I don't have the bitterness streak in me. I told you last week when I was going to be hoping that the Crokes do well. So yeah, no, I hope Cork can somehow figure out a way to get out of it.
One last thing: the hurling league has been ruined by the fact that the hurling championship has been fixed, and that's how it should be. The hurling championship is now a brilliant championship. All the matches matter. There's no coasting through to the latter stages the way there might have been in previous years. And as a result, the league is now just a warm-up.
Yeah, I would say a more feeling-out process. You know, you talked about it earlier on, teams don't want to show their hand. I'd say there's a good bit of that goes on during the league from what I've seen from teams trying out fellas and making sure everybody gets a chance. And, you know, In hurling, the championship is unbelievable, and the league isn't what it's cracked up to be. And in the football, the league is absolutely the best tournament by a mile, and the championship isn't living up to what it's supposed to be. So there has to be a look at it from both sides.
Yeah, no, totally. And the law of unintended consequences. We see what happens when you run a championship properly. Kieran, good stuff. Episode 3 of the Shot Clock is in the books. You can email us shotclock@offtheball.com. We'll see you next week. Yeah, we'll be going to the mailbag next week for you. shotclock@offtheball.com. We obviously recorded that yesterday, as you can tell, because I'm not wearing the same clothes. And I got my hair cut, you clowns. Didn't even spot it. Look at you.
Is it getting to that stage where haircuts are just getting unnoticeable?
Oh, shut. We control your mic, Owen. Just remember that. At all times, we control your mic. Darren, how are you? Good morning to you.
Oh, very well this morning, Ger. Start with some big breaking news. Johnny Sexton, among a number of players raising concerns about the proposed World Rugby League, the 12-team tournament, is reportedly a step closer to fruition after teams from the Rugby Championship and Six Nations agree to join the United States and Japan for a new competition. Each union will reportedly be paid €8.5 million a season for their participation. Early indications are that the competition could commence from November 2020. Speaking through the International Rugby Players Group, the world's top players have warned of serious player welfare and integrity concerns around the proposed competitions. Among their issues are player load challenges from multiple top-level test matches in different countries and time zones in consecutive weeks, increased long-haul travel in short time frames, a lack of real opportunities for Tier 2 nations to progress because there'd be no relegation promotion scenario, increased conflicts between country and club demands, potential impact on Rugby World Cup and Lions tours, and the long-term quality and, crucially, integrity of the international game. Now, Sexton quoted as saying, "While players gave this idea a cautious welcome when we met at the end of last year, it now seems like a commercial deal on the future of the game is being negotiated at a rapid pace with little consideration given to the important points we raised with World Rugby in November. The issue of player loads have never been so topical, however, needs to be properly understood. To suggest that players can play five incredibly high-level test matches in consecutive weeks in November is out of touch and shows little understanding of the physical strain this brings."
Right.
Big story brewing. That statement came out about 2 hours ago from the International Rugby Players Group.
Right.
So they had a big conference call on Tuesday where they discussed this and all their concerns were raised, and now they've gone public to highlight them because they felt that the issues and concerns they raised with World Rugby at that meeting back in November, when this was at tentative discussion phases, obviously was not taken into consideration in any kind of meaningful way, judging by their statement.
I mean, so they've issued... Have World Rugby confirmed that this is their intention for 2020?
No, it's all very much in the realms of this is the plan they hope to pursue, but there's nothing concrete on it.
Okay, so this is almost getting out ahead of that and making sure that you're trying to prevent it from happening straight away.
Yeah, it's a preemptive strike, it would seem.
Yeah, okay. It's interesting because, what is the future for rugby? Is it more international matches or is it more club matches? I'm not sure. Like, do you get as excited about the club matches as you do the Sale fans? Are they actually just England fans who are going to Sale matches? Obviously Sale and London Irish and Harlequins think that they can harness a local area and be very profitable, but ultimately it's international rugby that everybody cares the most about. So
I don't know, to fill these test windows, aren't they, with something that actually has a trophy at the end.
I didn't realise that the Pacific Islands would be completely locked out of this 12 team. Japan and America are in, but you good teams over there that we can pilfer players from and have been doing for 100 years, you can't come in, even though you're clearly good enough.
With no prospect of coming in as well. I think that's one of the main concerns highlighted by the players group this morning, is that relegation promotion, while it may have been considered at early stages of the conversation, it seems to have disappeared from what is moving closer to being a final proposal in the next few months.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the Pacific Island market is nowhere near ripe for penetration as Japan and the USA is. It's absolutely different stratosphere, so commercially it makes absolutely no sense to leave Japan and USA out of this. And this is a commercial move. Clearly is a commercial move. From a welfare point of view, it's obviously a bad one, if you've got Johnny Sexton saying that this morning. Clearly they look at whatever football have done over the last couple of decades and it's like more matches have led to more money and more popularity. It's a win-win-win, except you're actually talking about a very unique sport here where more playing is actually damaging to each individual player and is actually affecting, like, we look at the Premiership at the moment and clearly more games is affecting some of their players as well. So I'm not sure.
I think that if there was a limit on the amount of games that everybody plays and the union paid pro rata or the majority of the salaries, then that would be fine. Like, if everybody agreed that 22 is the optimum number of games, or whatever is agreed, right? Let's pick 22 as a working example. And 8 of those are going to be internationals and 14 of those are going to be club games. And you can't play anymore unless you're signed off by an independent doctor at the end of the season. So it's semi-final, final. You're allowed to play extra games. And then something like this could work. So you have an international window and you're not going to play all 5 games in November. So this isn't an issue. You'll play 3 of those games and you will work that out with the union and your fitness coach. But so you have much bigger squads of playing international rugby, and those games, at the end of it, the team with the best squad wins. Like, it's not impossible to work something like this out. It's just that they're not doing it.
The time frame to condense it over 5 weeks seems to be the major concern.
Playing a game every week. Yeah, I guess, you know, if you had a rule, though, that nobody can play more than 3 of those games. Like, you're getting into the type of collective bargaining stuff that, in fairness, the NFL have proven that, like, it's a really hard, long process, but it is possible to legislate that you can have this amount of full contact training sessions, you can have this amount of sessions in pads, you can do this amount of contact hours, and outside of that window you're not allowed to contact your own players. You can't work with your players in the off season, for there's a proper off season. And if any of that ever gets broken, the players report their own teams because the union is so strong, and then teams lose, there's proper punishment for the teams. Like, it is possible to work out a structure where you had a set number of games, and then all the leagues would have to have their best players available for certain times. And so, like, it could have a knock-on impact and grow the game. It's possible if everybody gets in and says, OK, this is what we want. But the billionaire English club owners are going to go, screw you, we get our way.
But maybe that's what this statement is. This is an invitation to the table to bring the players in a more meaningful way, because at this moment it would appear that there's a zero appetite for the current proposals in whatever form they're taking, or even if there's no concrete proposals, the form they believe it's going to take, the shape they believe. It's very brave of them as well, because when you consider that the unions are reported to be paying between 8.5 and 10 million a year for their participation, for players to come out and speak against something that the unions are probably all trying to make happen.
That would be on top of whatever they're getting for the Tri Nations and Six Nations. So this is just beefing up that window, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Soccer next, and Jurgen Klopp has told Liverpool fans to strap in and enjoy the ride. They retain their slim advantage at the top of the table after smashing Watford 5-0 to stay a point clear in the Premier League. Sadio Mane and Virgil van Dijk both scored twice as the Reds recorded their biggest win of the season. Divock Origi completed the rout as they returned to winning ways in some style, and Jurgen Klopp couldn't be happier.
Look, I don't get them. I'm not aware of the noise from outside. I realize in press conferences how the mood is, because journalists in Liverpool are quite passionate, and I feel it. They try to be positive, but they can see in their eyes they oh. So that's the moment. But I know anyway what the mood is. We have now 69 points or so. So we maybe could have 75. That's possible. But come on, let's don't get nuts. We play a really, really good season, and let's enjoy it and enjoy the ride. Let's go as far as it takes us. And we try every week to play like this. But we all know now we go to Everton. And yeah, they are not there to give us presents, of course. So we will go there and try it again, and hopefully it works out.
Manchester City kept the pressure on by beating West Ham 1-0 last night. The Tottenham manager Mauricio Pochettino says their title hopes are completely over after a 2-0 defeat at Chelsea saw them fall 8 points adrift. Spurs have lost back-to-back games, having been beaten by Burnley last Saturday. Pochettino says they must regroup now and focus on the top four.
We need to be focusing in trying to win games. That is the most important. Of course, if you win games, you are going to be in a good position. But of course, always the challenge. We are fighting with big sides, with big clubs. That all we want to be on the top four. And yes, at the moment we are six for four places, and it's going to be tough for sure. Two teams are going to be out of the top four, and we need to be sure that we keep our position. But of course, we need to fight for that.
Chelsea 7 points behind Spurs with a game in hand. You're saying surely not?
Surely not. No.
I mean, imagine if Chelsea manages to finish the top four.
Not happening.
Well, like, I think there's every chance it does, assuming last night just wasn't a false dawn from a Chelsea perspective. Like, it did help that they came up against a Woj's, to use a Brian Kerr phrase, Spurs team last night. Not a single shot on target. A goalkeeper who looks completely devoid of all inspiration at the moment. Not that you need much inspiration to be a goalkeeper. Terrible last night, Hugo Lloris. Chelsea there, it's a huge opportunity. Look who's above them. It's Spurs and Arsenal. Like, Manchester United are probably going to get top four at this place, unless we've just seen the start of their bad luck with injuries. They probably need a few more for them to fall down a little bit deeper. Like, if you want any two teams to be above you, if you're chasing any position, you want Tottenham Hotspur and Arsenal to be those two teams. And Chelsea have exactly that. It is on. It's going to be a fantastic top four race.
Man United finishing third?
Definitely.
Yeah, like, I think a lot of people call that, actually, after the opening run of games.
They're fifth now. I mean, it's not a definite, like... The win last night was sensational, I think, just in terms of the available playing staff.
Missing 10 players. It was an incredible turnaround.
Stat from last night, Romelu Lukaku has now joined the top 20 Premier League goal scorers of all time, alongside Dion Dublin. Better strike rate than Dion Dublin? Just looking at it...
A million times better strike rate than Dion.
Better strike rate, I think, than Nicolas Anelka.
Really?
Yeah, I need to actually do the maths on that. He's got 111 goals. Nicolas Anelka has 125.
He was way ahead of almost everybody in Premier League history in terms of the age at which he scored those goals.
Yeah.
So I think Rooney would have been ahead of him, but he's right up there with a bunch of other players. You're like, ooh, they all became absolute legends of the Premier League.
Mm. Yeah, and another two from last night. Solskjaer described him afterwards as a good boy.
He is a good boy.
Solskjaer kind of used Instagram captions to describe his players.
Speaking of a good boy, Kepa Arrizabalaga back in the good books, it seems, with Maurizio Sarri. Despite being benched yesterday, the Italian dropped the goalkeeper for Chelsea's victory over Tottenham. He drafted in Willy Caballero finally into the starting 11 after Kepa refused to be subbed during the League Cup final defeat to Manchester City. He was handed a €225,000 fine by the club, although he and Sarri initially said it was a misunderstanding. Sarri said he was trying to send a message to his squad that no player is bigger than the team and they must function as a unit and not individuals. Now, Manchester United Inter manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has heaped praise on Romelu Lukaku. As Owen rightly said, he's a good boy for seizing his chance. The big Belgian scored twice in a 3-1 win over Crystal Palace. He has played second fiddle to Marcus Rashford for most of the season, but with the Englishman out injured, Lukaku played a starring role for United. Solskjaer heaped praise on the striker and debutant James Garner.
Key for a striker, you have to look forward to the next chance, be focused, and he's slotted them two really well. Special for him, yeah. He's been with us training for a long while now. He was with us over Christmas period and was close to getting his debut then. He's a midfielder in the mould of Michael Carrick's that we'll definitely see a lot of. He's got great lines about him, good passer of the ball. So hopefully we can see loads of him in the next few weeks.
And finally, the excitement building towards another round of SSE Airtricity League First Division fixtures. And after brilliant hype video attempts from St Pat's, Bows and Rovers in the close season, Shells have got in on the act a bit too late for Oscar season though. But Simon Crowe and Shane Dawson have gone through a whirlwind trip through Shelburne's history. Take a look.
We've come a long way since 1895. The Reds were an old institution. 13 leagues and 11 cups. It's not a bad haul. And we've had a few decent memories here.
Tony Sheridan. Sheridan still has the control, trying to love the keeper.
Dublin. It's red and white. A city famous for its legends. Johnny Fortycoats, Ronnie and Luke, Joyce, Beckett, and a little magician from Portland Road. We're a club where the language and customs of a traditional Dublin live on. It's all about the glory, the heartbreak, the anger. It's all about the fans. The L Reds, well, it's a special kind of home. One club unified by a common goal of success. We've been through it all, highs and lows, good enough for a Joycean prose. The highs, euphoric, the lows, catastrophic. But this is a new era, a time for new ways, where heroes emerge and bring back the glory days.
Will that turn you on? Will you leave your precious bows to...
Well,
is that enough to get you on a bandwagon?
What are you doing picking bows? You're living much closer to Shells.
Good point, actually.
Did you pick Bowes?
Well,
you didn't.
Yeah,
you're a glory hunter, Premier League only.
Born winner, top of the league.
Jesus.
Unbeaten. Oh, 100%, I should say.
You've got a Dubstat first?
You should be a Shells fan.
Oh, yeah, Dubstat. Three Dublin players who've started every All-Ireland final in the last decade.
Keane O'Sullivan.
Ah, oh, bollocks. You got the hardest one straight off the bat.
Cluxton. And
did you read this in the papers today?
No.
Did you put together the fact that he's in all the papers today with me suddenly?
No. Keane O'Sullivan, Cluxton, and Billy?
No.
I wouldn't say. Yeah.
You got one more guess? I've now forgotten.
I remember.
Okay.
James
McCarthy.
Ah,
of course,
McCarthy. Yeah.
Jesus, I would have said Keane O'Sullivan was the hardest one. Maybe it wasn't. It's just because he's been injured for so long.
It's just because he's got that new disguise going on.
It's the moustache.
The passion from Cluxton. When was the last time we did see Cluxton? Evan Comerford playing fierce well.
Tommy made a ridiculous point yesterday and I couldn't believe it.
On air.
The GAA show.
Oh, yeah,
tried to pass it off as a real thing of just look how good Evan Comerford was playing in Croke Park. I mean, it's that Croke Park experience. He's played there twice, Tommy.
In the home comfort of
no.
Croke Park.
He has played there twice.
He's played Robbie twice.
Henley's played there more than he has.
Ah, no. He's played, look, he played loads of league games and he played that one game in the Championship that time that Cluxton had.
Last year against Leash was in the Leinster final.
I'd still say Henley's played more games than Croke Park.
But like Henley is Comerford. Playing with like the closest challengers to Dublin over the last since 2011.
Right, Nathan is with us to talk about the football last night. Nathan, you went to stalk Declan Rice. How did it go?
I can't hear words you're saying to me, lads.
Okay. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Get the Dublin County Board off that show.
Hey.
Get out of here.
Yeah, he's sneaking past the camera as we speak.
I think there's a bit of a delay, so maybe talk to him.
Okay, there seems to be a bit of a delay, as everybody just heard now, because the door opened when Tommy was saying that. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Ah.
Loud and clear, Chair.
Hello, Rath Farnham. What are your votes?
I'm in Manchester.
Okay.
This is not a picture in my house.
No, that's why it's nailed on. You know, the way your kids get on. Come here. You tried to speak to Declan Rice last night. What happened?
Obviously, I'm not overly surprised. He walked through the mix zone, hat on, head down, and said, "You're grand, thanks."
Pretty much what he did to Ireland, right?
I attempted to turn to him and say, "Why would you turn your back on me like you turned your back on the people of Ireland?" But I thought that might be unprofessional in a mix zone.
I mean, you would have gone viral, so...
Well, a little bit.
It's what Donald Trump put it on.
Exactly, but... Let him on with his life.
So tell us about the football last night, because it seemed, certainly from your tweets, that, you know, not that you've got a horse in the race or anything here, but you were seeing signs of weakness, signs of choking from Manchester City last night.
I don't know. I think could have won that 5-0 last night, and it would have been a fair result. But also, if West Ham had scored a late goal, it probably would have served them right. They flew out of the blocks, City. They could have been... They had four brilliant chances inside the first 5 minutes. They hit the post, but then they just sort of got a little bit slow, a little bit more pedestrian, overcomplicating it. The fans, actually, you know, we talk about nerves at Anfield. Once news came in of that first goal for Liverpool, it was around a similar time that West Ham finally started to find their way into the game, and the City fans were getting very frustrated, particularly at Riyad Mahrez. Every time an attack broke down, every time a counter-attack didn't finish with an attempt on target, they were really getting on their players' backs. They deserve to win the game, there's no question. Like West Ham, it was one of the most unambitious performances I have ever seen from an away side. It looked as though they just came in the hope that they wouldn't get absolutely battered. But then right at the start of the second half, they made a change. Samir Nasri was useless in the first half, never got a touch of the ball. They're bringing on Manuel Lanzini, who's back from injury. He creates a great chance for Andy Carroll, close range, Ederson saves, and within a couple of minutes, City make the changes. They take off Mahrez and Sané, bring on Sterling and Bernardo Silva. Like, what substitutions to be able to make? And they make an instant impact. Bernardo Silva wins a pretty soft penalty. I'm not sure if you saw it. One of those where he's cutting in from the right-hand side. He sticks his left foot across Felipe Anderson, and there's basically nothing Felipe Anderson can do but sort of run into the back of him. There wasn't even much contact in that. And they get the penalty. Aguero slots it away. 18 goals for the season. And West Ham didn't really create too many chances. I wouldn't be overly worried if I was a Manchester City fan. They had extra time against Chelsea in the Carabao Cup final. I'm sure they went and celebrated that a little bit. They just looked ever so slightly off. And also, I think when I looked at that starting team from City, probably four of their five best players this season weren't in that team. Laporte and Fernandinho are both going to be out probably till the end of March. And then you also have Sterling and Bernardo Silva on the bench. So you get those two back even. I think it's a far more clinical Manchester City.
Yeah, but I mean, Owen was making the case earlier in the season that Fernandinho was a good outside bet for Footballer of the Year. There was a point where he was being talked about in hushed tones as this kind of Jenga piece of the entire house of cards at Manchester City would fall down if he wasn't there. If he's going to be out for a month, it's not nothing.
It's not nothing, but and it may impact them more in the Champions League than the Premier League, because they've got a brilliant run of fixtures before they take on Spurs and Manchester United in April. They've got five games you would expect them to win every day of the week. I think they've got Bournemouth, Watford, Fulham, Cardiff, Crystal Palace. Could not ask for five better games from City if you're going to be without both Laporte and Fernandinho. But
we're going to try and re-establish the Skype connection, because it looks like you had a stroke in the middle of speaking there, and that's not good.
When he was doing his shouty bit earlier on, saying, "Why don't you come back and play for Ireland?" It just kind of came after a bit of a lag, so it looked like he'd just gone silent for a while and had just had a bit of a fit.
It burped out.
Interesting. Like, it's Like Manchester City have like put up incredible statistics, as we know, over the past season and a half. And I think it was the first time all season, I know it was the first time all season, according to Daniel Taylor's match report, that they failed to score twice or more in any game at their own ground. And you think, oh, well, are they starting to show signs of, you know, frailties here? But the fact is, no other side has managed that kind of record over a 15-game period in the top division since Spurs in 1965. So they're still hitting historic heights this season. And I think that just puts into context what Liverpool are doing themselves.
Yeah, in fairness, Nathan, we should talk about that whatever happens from this point forward, Liverpool winning 5-0 last night put an end to the whole talk of wobble. It's the last day in February today. They will beat the league leaders into March against a historically good Man City team. This is a proper title race between two brilliant teams.
Yeah, and listen, I wouldn't overly get carried away about Liverpool last night either and the end of their stuttering, because it's only a couple of weeks ago that they beat Bournemouth at home by 3-0 and everyone felt that was Liverpool back to their very best. Whereas, listen, last night was a different level again against Watford, and they trained Alexander-Arnold back, and I'd say Jurgen Klopp regrets not starting him against Manchester United with the amount of ball that James Milner wasted at the weekend. But this is a remarkable run from Liverpool. The statistic you see this morning is they already have a better points total than 16 previous entire Premier League seasons. What they've done is pretty spectacular. They've only been beaten once all season, remember, but it's not really going to matter for anything unless they can somehow see it out, and they need to follow it up at Goodison Park on Sunday. Yeah, like, I think with Liverpool, part of the problem, and you know, you talk about atmosphere in the grounds, is everything with Liverpool is too high or too low. Like, a draw against Manchester United, not playing at your very best away from home, isn't a disaster, but also winning 5-0 at home against an unbelievably inconsistent Watford doesn't mean that suddenly they're back. I think we'll know whether they're back to their very best on Sunday at Goodison. And the one real positive for Liverpool is they have shown this season, when Divock Origi scored that late goal against Everton at Anfield, that they went on this run for the next month where there was nobody could live with them. And if last night's a sign that they're back to that, well, I think you would still have them as strong favourites to win the title.
I don't know about strong favourites at this point. And just to talk about the Bournemouth game, they didn't, like, they missed a lot of chances. They were kind of nervy in that game. And Bournemouth, I think, were losing their eighth successive away fixture. Watford were playing well recently and had definitely brought a little bit of form into that game, coming off a big victory themselves. Now, granted, we're making this point a little bit earlier on, they had just hit the magical 40 points mark and no doubt had celebrated in much more meaningful fashion than Man City celebrated after their Carabao Cup win. So maybe there's a little bit of that to take it. But I think as well, like, I would put far more store in this performance than that one. As you point out, Trent Alexander-Arnold starting a game, the first, second player in history, the youngest player in history to have a hat-trick of assists.
I think that's correct, Nathan. You might correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think that sounds like something I also read on Twitter last night.
The thing that I kind of picked up on last night is that, like, you talk about Liverpool and the fact that they have such prowess to actually beat a team 5-0 without being at their 100% best, which is incredible to think. But they only do that when they have all their attacking parts on the field. And beating a team 5-0 without Roberto Firmino is an impressive feat indeed.
Yeah, obviously they changed things last night in the decision to play Sadio Mane down. I was surprised. It was one of the surprising aspects of Sunday at Old Trafford that Jurgen Klopp never changed this in terms of the front three's role. Like, Mo Salah wasn't having a good day. Luke Shaw had the beating of him every time. But when you have a player of Mo Salah's talent, why not just move him? Why not switch it for 20 minutes? Firmino had already gone off the pitch. Why not move Origi out to the wing and Salah out to the left, or play him through the middle, and at least give teams something else to think about? And Watford couldn't have expected last night that Sadio Mane was the player to play down the middle. So I think maybe there's something in that for Klopp as well, that he needs to try something different from time to time to make them slightly less predictable. The other positive I felt for Liverpool last night was obviously Van Dijk getting a couple of goals, because for all his brilliance, the one thing that he probably hasn't brought to Liverpool is goals. For somebody of his size and stature, he's not the real presence you would expect a lot of the time from set pieces. If they can add that over the next couple of months and get the goals, I think, listen, it's another outlet there. And the other thing I would say as well is, like, at home, Liverpool are nearing on 2 years now undefeated. So at Anfield, they don't seem to have too many problems, no matter who they're playing against.
Who knew Manchester was such a black spot for good Wi-Fi coverage? Or else we've just put you in a crappy hotel. But I presume you got a good night's sleep anyway.
Very much so.
One last thing, Nathan. What's your take on how the rest of the Champions League places are going to go? Who's going to come third through to sixth?
I think Spurs will still finish top three. I think Pochettino's shown an ability to bounce back from disappointing results, and I think Spurs will still finish third in the table. I would probably go United top four. You just couldn't trust Arsenal in the tight games, in the tougher games against other teams in the top four, where United have shown over the past couple of months that they can get a point where they need it. They can, like, they've already gone and beaten Tottenham. They got that draw against Liverpool. Arsenal are still just too flaky. You wouldn't be at all surprised if Arsenal drop points in a game this weekend. And Chelsea, unless somehow what happened with Kepa at the weekend is this great unifying force that turns out to be a turning point in their season, again, I wouldn't trust them enough. I just think United have the momentum and have the ability to probably get results when they're not playing at their best right now, whereas Arsenal just don't have that.
Yeah, way more momentum than your Wi-Fi coverage this morning, Nathan. Enjoy the rest of the quiet time that you have before we'll see you in the office a little bit later on. Take care.
Cheers, lads.
Nathan Murphy at the game last night.
Yeah, the best chant for many supporters last night were Tottenham fans to Maurizio Sarri saying, you can't even make a sub, which is probably my favourite of all time. And I hope this just like rolls on forever and ever and ever until the point where Maurizio Sarri perhaps even wins a Premier League with his Chelsea side. I'm fully buying into the fact that this is the unifying force that is.
Okay, so they're going to finish fourth.
I think Arsenal, as Nathan alluded to there,
so like, Spurs, you're actually predicting Spurs dropping out of the top four, really?
I'm slightly worried about Spurs, I'm very worried. The team I'm most confident, I'll put it this way, the team I'm most confident of finishing top four out of those four teams at the moment is Manchester United.
Who are 5 points behind Spurs.
Yeah, and like that is counting, I think a lot of people are actually getting ahead of themselves in terms of the idea that, if Arsenal beat them this weekend, it's going to be a 1 point gap between them and Tottenham Hotspur. Arsenal have to go to Wembley and actually beat Spurs. That's an important caveat in this whole discussion.
Are they going to lose three games in a row? They're not.
I'm not sure. Like, just a quick point on Arsenal last night, because I had them on kind of as a second screen with Chelsea Spurs. Like, I think it's such an obvious point, but it's worth pointing out again that Mesut Ozil is, without question, Arsenal's most talented player. In terms of ability, in terms of being a player who's not mediocre Europa League standard, which quite a lot of this Arsenal squad is, he goes against all of that.
He was
playing more essentially, kind of in the 10 position. Obviously, you can make an argument that Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is the most talented player that Arsenal have, but I would definitely contend that it's Mesut Ozil, and Aubameyang is actually a bit behind him. I thought he was just sublime last night again, but it is just one of those things where he kind of does it when he wants to. And is there a question about Unai Emery? Do you pander to him to the point where he gets you over the line potentially in terms of the top four position? Because when he's playing like that, like last night, there is a potential for Arsenal to finish top four. If you take Ozil out of the squad entirely, I think that they are, by definition, the sixth best team in the Premier League.
You re-establish Ozil's value and you sell him and get somebody who does it week in, week out, who you can trust and build a team around.
Yes, but so this is just a temporary
thing. Yeah, oh, totally. Yeah, you're so good. It's amazing.
Exactly.
Your politics are a bit weird, but that's okay. We all have our quirks, right? That's fine. We turn a blind eye to much worse things.
Yeah. It's like the Chinese restaurant in South Park, you know, just pander all left, right, and centre, just pander all the time, pander to Mesut Ozil.
How do they do it?
Well, I'm not sure. I need to go and watch back that episode to actually brush up my South Park knowledge.
So the front three, Mkhitaryan, Aubameyang, and Ozil all scored. I just remember early in the season when Lucas Torreira was like the best midfielder in the Premier League for about 3 week period. Do you remember that? There was like, wow, this guy, we've learned how to pronounce his name.
On.
He's absolutely amazing. Better than Kante. Do you remember that?
Best midfielder in the Premier League.
Oh, there was a mad hype about how they got him on the cheap, comparatively. What was it, only 20 million? Was it less even?
Yeah, like, best midfield signing of the season, potentially.
Look, I'm saying...
Liverpool fans will say it's...
There was loads of hype bullshit around it. But he was supposed to be a fix for all of the issues they had. They signed him and they'd signed... here was a manager who understood, we have issues here and here and here. We're going to sign.
Yeah, and he still has been very, very good. He's been one of the players that they have signed that hasn't kind of looked bog-standard Europa League. At times, Matteo Guendouzi has looked like he's not going to be bog-standard Europa League either, that he might be a bit better than that. And then he kind of makes a complete cock-up last night for the goal they conceded, which is just kind of pure Arsenal. And perhaps they should have conceded more last night. Leno pulled off an incredible save really early on after Arsenal had gone 1-0 up. And it was one of those games where it's like Arsenal, you know, have scored like 4 or 5 goals here, but they could have conceded a similar amount at the other end as well. So, like, everything you say about this football club is still heavily asterisked, as in, it's Arsenal.
I do want to remind everybody that we've got a brilliant competition running all this week on OTBAM with thanks to Dove Men Plus Care. The winner will join the IRFU kitman, John Moran, as he prepares the dressing room for the Irish rugby team ahead of their final training session before the big game against France. So this is the captain's run, effectively. You'll also get a pair of tickets to see Ireland against France at the Aviva the following day. It's our last home game of the season. To give you the chance to win, tell us your favourite rugby jersey. Tweet it into us or comment wherever you're watching the show. That could be on YouTube or Facebook. Make sure you use the hashtag TeamCare. That's all one word on the hashtag TeamCare. And also the hashtag OTBAM so we can search for you and to know that you've entered. We've been collecting your entries all week. Some good ones. Some pretty grotesque ones as well. A lot of times there's a lot of wankology when it comes to jersey design. And you'd like to go plain, plain, plain. So this one is top rugby jersey has to be New Zealand Warriors. 1, class design. 2, the meaning and culture. 3, the colour and Vodafone, which makes it ideal for Irish games and Paddy's Day. I see that if you're an Ireland fan wearing this to an Ireland game, I can see why you would do that, right? I can see that. Personally, I hate it. I think that it's, you know, and I understand that there's like a lot of cultural stuff going on, but like,
you're not disrespecting the culture to say it's a crap jersey.
Is it not actually disrespecting the culture to put it on a jersey that way, like a little bit?
Well, you know? Fair point.
Like, you know,
that's a horror show.
There's a lot of our culture that you're like, okay, that looks good in the Book of Kells.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be basically like putting the Book of Kells on, which remember it's Gospels. But, so it'd be like putting the Book of Kells on the Leinster jersey or the Dublin jersey. No thanks. I mean, okay, yeah, fair enough.
Those
proclamation jerseys?
I was just about to say the 1916 jerseys.
Ah, puke. Puke.
Like, I'm all for a nod to history and to culture if it's done in a manner that befits a jersey.
Yeah.
Like that classic Cork jersey that they brought out, what was it, 2 years ago?
Oh, I don't remember that.
3 years ago, where they went back to 100 years ago for the original one. It was a different colour, it was blue, wasn't it?
Oh, those different colour jerseys. That was class.
Yeah.
That was like the colour rush that they do
in the NFL.
They're amazing.
Yeah.
Great idea.
That
South African jersey, also a classic.
Yes, we brought that up yesterday as well. You can't really beat that one. Now this.
ASICS and Mandela Foundation created South African Blitzbox jersey to celebrate Nelson Mandela's 100th birthday.
This I don't mind.
It's alcohol-free beer.
Well, you see, the sponsor works in perfectly with the colour. That makes a bit more sense than the previous one we saw. I like that a lot.
I mean, I don't know.
Like, I wouldn't wear it, but I can admire it. I can say, fair play. If you can pull that jersey off, by all means.
Look, I don't know. Maybe I'm just being like an old white man and actually, you know, do whatever you want. This Highlanders away jersey. There's a bang of the Adidas 1980s Germany thing with the perspective of the design, which I like.
Mm.
It's definitely a historic knot. But the 3 stripes, hard to beat on a jersey.
Yeah,
it just works.
Yeah, no, you're right. The Adidas.
O'Neill's have the right to 3 stripes in Ireland.
Yeah.
Which is mad.
It's great. It's fantastic. It means our GAA jerseys are far better looking than they used to be.
Yeah. All right. So, let's move on. We're going to hear from Leo Cullen speaking with Owen in a minute. First, though, Keith Wood. Here he is talking about whether or not the Ireland team have been found out in the Six Nations so far.
I think they slow down the ruck ball. That's the first point. Conor Murray is going in digging for ball. Mm. He's stepping over people, wading over people virtually every time he's going in there. And he's 6'3" or whatever height he is. He's never going to be the fastest and never was the fastest at that spot. He wants cleaner ball all the time. And we probably need to be making it a little bit easier for our 9 and 10. The opposition line speed has changed radically. So the hard push up from 7 and outside 7, 10 to 13 in the face of every player that's there. And they're not missing a whole lot of tackles. So that's the second point.
Mm.
For our kicking game, which is a big attacking ploy for us, they've been shielding all our chasing runners. And there's been a change, whether it's a change in the law's interpretation, but since the autumn, that has changed. If you look now, when the ball is kicked up, you'll see six people in between the catcher and Ireland's runners. And the last point is there seems to be an increase in the dominant tackles. We're calling it dominant tackles now, but in the big hits that we would have said. They're highlighting the players that are getting the ball and they're making those hit early. So I'd say that on one part of it. The other part of it is we are missing some key players. So our 9 and 10 are struggling a little bit in their confidence and they're carrying the can all the time. But they seem to be two of the players that are carrying an awful lot more than they even did last year.
Yeah, because there's no Ringrose and there's no Henshaw to help lift the burden. So suddenly it's like Sexton has to bring the ball to the line, smashed. Bring the ball to the line, smashed. It's like if Henshaw's there, he can go in first receiver, he can carry. Second can get it after him. Ringrose can go in first receiver. He can carry, make a bit of space. It's just, I think it's become fairly obvious that the 12 and 13 partnership of our first choice is actually a good bit ahead, I think, than everybody else. And also, Henshaw's a 13, or Henshaw's a centre, not a fullback. And there's just been this mad knock-on impact of all the things that have happened. We'll be fine, basically.
Yeah, it feels like we're kind of spinning around and we're a little bit dizzy at the moment. But like, this is the time to be doing it.
Yeah,
this
fall down now and get back up.
It really does feel. I'm not sure. Is it just been so long since we've kind of felt this? But it is kind of weird being in this funk where you're like watching Joe Schmidt doing his post-match interviews and he's kind of like, I don't really know what's going on. Maybe as I say, it's just because we've gone so long with actually having a very successful team, aka all of last year. I've forgotten what Josh actually sounds like when he's a little bit mystified.
I think he knows exactly what's going on. He's just not going to tell us. What's happening is that
that'd be a very cute who remove
not to tell us.
But I say, kind of put on that mirage.
I mean, come on, he has adapted all the best aspects of our sports culture immediately.
But that is the very best part of our sports culture.
Right. 10 years ago, we were on our way to our first Grand Slam since the 40s. We were also witnessing the birth of the Leinster team as a European powerhouse because they went on to win the Heineken Cup in fairly spectacular fashion, driven by man-of-the-match performances throughout the competition by Rocky Elsom. Obviously, the head coach was Michael Checa. Stars of that team included Brian O'Driscoll, Shane Jennings, Gordon Darcy. And they're all reuniting for a massive night to celebrate the 2009 Heineken Cup team. It's a gala evening and all of the surplus monies raised from the evening is going to be shared between a charity chosen by the 2009 players, the current Leinster Rugby Charity Partners and the Leinster Foundation. So they launched this event yesterday and to help launch it, they gave us some access to Leo Cullen and Leo and Owen sat down together and here's how the conversation went.
Leo Cullen, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yep. Great time of year. Lovely weather outside. Living the dream in many ways.
It must be like peak rugby season kind of comes along with, you know, snow and terrible weather all the time. But this is, looking out the window today, it just feels like it should be the off season.
I know. I actually had that thought. I had a second or third layer on today. I was actually going to take this off. It was amazing to think. So middle of February. For us, like we're working away sort of behind the scenes at the moment. It's always a great time of year, this Six Nations period, I think, for Leinster, with, you know, what we hope always is a lot of guys away on international duty, and you get to work more with a lot of the younger players. And that group is working very hard at the moment. Another big game for us against Cheetahs on Friday night, so another opportunity for a lot of our guys. So, you know, it's a great time of year, but it does feel like we've escaped winter this year. Last year we played in this block and then we had there was Storm Ophelia and there was the beast or whatever that was called with the snow, and we had a game that was called off against Scarlets, and it was quite a disruptive period. So in comparison, yeah, it's incredible now this year. Yeah, it's sun out and people in t-shirt and shorts in middle of February. It's amazing.
It's very unusual. We are here because we're launching the Champions of 2009 Gala Dinner. As it says on the tin, it's all about 10 years ago, that incredible Heineken Cup win. It must feel like yesterday.
It is strange to think back. Like it is hard to think back when you're in the sporting bubble, and it's just always like the next game that's coming up. But 2009... It does seem like a long time ago in many ways, but like there's the memories of that season are so clear in my mind. So it was it was an unusual season. It was very mixed in terms of the pool campaign, where we struggled really to get out of the group. We'd been pretty much written off after those December games where we bombed a couple of chances in the home game here against Cast in round three, and then lost away in round four, and then we were picking up all sorts of tags after that game. So to come through and actually qualify from the pool was hard work. Then there was the Bloodgate game in the quarterfinal. It was such a big fallout from that game. We were oblivious to most of it at the time. But to think of how close that game was, the 6-5, Harlequins missed a few kicks during the game, and it was such a big moment in that club's history for very, very different reasons. But how close we were to being out of the tournament at that stage. And then there's the game in Croke Park against Munster, where I remember in the press before, where literally nobody gave us a chance in that game either. So to come through and face Leicester Tigers in the final, who obviously had a bit of history with, having played there for 2 years between 2005 and 2007. Had some great memories over there. I was very fortunate to be involved in a very competitive group of players, eventually to get over the line, it was amazing. Very such a different time in terms of the expectation and the sense of belief. We were very brittle as a group, I think, in terms of confidence, self belief, and not having really delivered on enough of the big days. So to finally take that step was a huge moment for a lot of people at the club. Most important thing for the club as a whole, as an organisation, was such an important step.
Yeah, it is very interesting. Like, when does that brittleness change to a solid confidence? Is it the Munster game?
I don't know. I think there was still a lot of doubts in the final. The way that game, I thought we were lucky in many ways, because Leicester had played in the Premiership final the week before against London Irish and won. And winning just takes that little bit of a competitive edge away from you, and they were probably stumbling into that final. I remember what it was like, because when I was in Leicester, we had played in the Premiership final and beaten Gloucester the week before the European Cup final, Ireland Cup final, and I was in Twickenham. So Leicester had played in the Premiership final in Twickenham, then the following week went back to play against Wasps and had hammered Wasps in the last round of the Premiership. Prior to that, Wasps had just been sort of bubbling in the background. But Wasps were too good on the day in that 2007 final, and Leicester were just lacked that bit of an edge. So, that's what I'd hoped going into that 2009 game. Maybe Leicester would lack a little bit of an edge. But ultimately, we just about did enough to win the game, even though it was a scrappy, untidy type of game, which was the case with a lot of our games that year. I thought we were scrappy, untidy, but just managed to get through, took chances when they came along, and there was a lot of, I suppose, will to get us there and get the results that we were after, but it was quite untidy in reality, I think, if you're looking back on those games.
So I guess we'll get into the Six Nations in just a moment, but just to kind of stick with Leinster for one last thing, it's going to be Ulster in the next round of the Champions Cup at the end of next month. We were just speaking at the top about 2009 Munster. The old provincial derbies really kind of go to another level when they're in Europe, don't they?
I remember that Ulster game in 2012. Ulster had won an away quarter final that year, another provincial derby, when they beat Munster down in Thomond. So we know on their day, Ulster are a hugely dangerous team. I remember the build up to that final 2012 and the hype that goes with that. And I remember the it's so clear in my mind, the drive into the ground in Twickenham, and you see two Irish teams in Twickenham. It's an amazing occasion. The blue and the white literally circle around the flags, and it's the sense of colour you get in some of those European days that are so clear, and that image in my mind, when the teams are coming out and you see the flags and the split, I can picture the same image in Croke Park and with the blue and the red. So they're pretty special days.
Obviously you're going to be going up there, or you're going to be coming up against them, and you're going to have a familiar face coming up against you in Geordie Murphy. I guess the question that's been on everybody's lips today is, Jack McGrath going to be one of those familiar faces with him next season?
Good question. Reality is, there's for whatever reason, like some of the other provinces, I think, are, you know, looking at some of the players that we have here, you know, and so you can argue about the merits of what's right and what's wrong. You know, for us, you know, we were just trying to create a place here that players can be as successful as they possibly can. So in the group environment, but also as individuals. So if they produce the right behaviours, you know, they get picked and hopefully go on and get picked at the highest level as well, whether that's with Ireland or even beyond, you know, with the Lions as well. You know, you mentioned Jack has obviously gone on and done that. So there's always bits going on behind the scenes with the squad, and that's, you know, something that we don't tend to air in a public domain, out of respect for all the different people that are involved. But you know, look, it's something that's, it goes on, I think continue to go on. You know, I think it's a good reflection when we have these questions. I think quite often it's a good reflection on, like, a lot of the good work that goes in the system here in terms of trying to produce players, and for us that's probably the thing that we can control. And then ultimately, like, it comes down to players, what they actually want to do in terms of some of the decisions that they make. You know, sometimes they make decisions, sometimes obviously it's the club makes the decision. Maybe there's not a space for certain players, but ultimately, like, those conversations are best kept, I think, in a private domain. You know, when there's announcements to be made and when there's a clear story or a clear picture, those things get announced. So out of respect for the individuals.
Yeah, like, in a general sense, I wonder, is there a question at the moment that Leinster are almost a victim of how many great players they're producing at the moment, that there's so much depth in every position, and ultimately the IRFU is looking at what's actually best for the national team, and obviously from your perspective you're thinking what's best for us here at Leinster?
Yeah, like, the main thing for us is that we continue to try and produce players, because I think, like, identity, I think, is important. I think, you know, we're very lucky that we have a lot of players that, you know, have grown up in the system. You know, talk to some of the players, you know, what's their first memory of Leinster like, and it's, you know, one of the players said, oh well, I was an 8-year-old playing at half time, and, you know, so I want the players to, like, inspire those 8-year-olds that are out there to, you know, want to play for this team, so Leinster being this team. So that's an important part, I think, that kids that grow up and come through the system and they've something to aspire to, they've seen it, you know, on the very various different routes there are to get there, whether it's through some of the schools or through some of the clubs. And yeah, like, it's real. It's the, you know, you can do it. Like, that's the pathway. I've seen it from all these different examples. So yeah, that's a more important focus for us. A lot of the other bits you can't control. There's, you know, other factors at play, and, you know, with other clubs' approaches, you know, agents, etc., etc. So that's just part and parcel of the business of sport that we're in. Not sure whether we are supposed to be professional, but it is now. It's a business, so there's the reality side of that. And, you know, some guys get opportunities to experience a whole host of different things. And depending on what stage guys are in their careers, maybe that's an attractive proposition. But, you know, for us, what do we control? We control trying to make this place to a place where people want to play, people want to aspire to play for. And, you know, sometimes that's trying to inspire, like, a Scott Fardy, who's maybe sitting on his couch in Australia and thinking, wonder what this team Leinster will be like playing for them, and he comes across and makes a big impact and, you know, really buys into what we're trying to do here as a team and has a massive impact on a whole host of other players, because of some of the experience that he's picked up and because he clearly has shown a desire that he wants to come here as well. We're lucky that he's decided to stay on.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that it's like, it doesn't take too much reading between the lines here at all, but it seems from what you're saying there that you want Jack to stay, and ultimately there are different things that you can't control in terms of what he's feeling, in terms of what the IRFU is feeling. Am I correct in assuming that?
I think you're assuming a lot there, so okay. I don't know. As I said, like, there's a respect for the people that are involved, you know, I just don't think it's a conversation for, you know, a media event. I think it's something that takes place behind the scenes, and we'll see how it plays out.
Fair enough. We just want to wrap up as well on the Six Nations. From a coaching perspective, I'd like to get your take on what we seem to be hearing from Joe Schmidt and the camp at the moment, which is that they're slightly mystified by what's actually going on so far in the Six Nations, that they can't quite figure out why this Ireland team is performing. Have you ever gone through anything like that, and can you sympathise with how difficult that must be?
I feel like we go through that all the time, because even when we win games, sometimes you don't perform particularly well. So sometimes the results hide the actual performance. You look back to the England game which was at in the Viva. And, you know, it was fine margins in that game. It was such an intense game. You know, England had this, you know, build this siege mentality. Everyone was talking up Ireland. There was this expectation Ireland were going to win the game. And it's such a, it just felt like it was, there was a trap being set here. England, I thought, produced a good tactical display. Ireland, you know, if you think some of the tries that were scored, that were, you know, possibly a forward pass for one of them, when Johnny May kicks the ball ahead, probably a forward pass in the build up to that. You know, Stockdale, like, you know, as he's about to collect the ball, he's played, and, you know, if he's managed to gather that ball, and then Ireland are chasing the game and they concede a try late on in the game. So it was such little fine margins in that game. And then in most campaigns, if you had a bonus point win away against Italy and a win against Scotland, like, that would be deemed pretty good, because there's maybe this bit of pressure building. And ultimately, there's been, like, Ireland have tried a huge amount of players as well in the campaign. So, you know, it's going to be hard to get a cohesive performance off the back of a lot of changes. But, you know, ultimately, they lost a very tight battle against a very good, strong English team who hit the campaign at a million miles an hour in a lot of good form, and then Ireland have backed it up with two wins since. So, you know, it's, I wouldn't be predicting or painting such a picture of doom and gloom. I think, you know, Ireland have lost a game against England that people have been building up that they would win, and since then they've gone away and won against Scotland, who have, you know, been on a good run of form, particularly at home again in Murrayfield. And, you know, we've, Ireland picked up a bonus point win again away against Italy. You know, I just played against Italy away before, where Italy took the lead in the last 10 minutes of the game, and Rog got a drop goal off the kickoff. You know, we kicked off, regathered the ball, and he coolly slotted a drop goal to win us the game, and you get out there with a win. And, you know, some of the Six Nations away from home is a little bit like that, smash and grab. So I think it's set up well. I think a lot of players have missed the last couple of rounds. I think a lot of guys will come back, I would hope, for the last couple of rounds. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly what sort of form France are in. Moments of brilliance and moments where they're not so good. But, you know, game on Sunday, then it's, can Ireland probably spoil the party against Wales? And, you know, Ireland are still very much in the hunt for the championship, depending on what happens in a few other games. So I wouldn't be as doom and gloomy.
It's an unusual sound to actually hear somebody who's not doom and gloomy around this Ireland team at the moment. So you don't think that there's a possibility that we have peaked at all last year, that even the performances of the likes of Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton are anything to be concerned about just yet? It's just they're working their way into top form from a 2019 perspective.
Yeah, I think it's more to the fact there's been a lot of chopping and changing, a lot of disruptions, little niggly injuries that has been picked up along the way. So I think once the get a bit more cohesion in terms of the selection of the team, I think Ireland would be a good place. Yeah, you look back to the New Zealand game, you know, it's not that long ago, it's in the middle of November. So, and I think all the provincial teams are in good form as well. I think the competition is good across the board, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's a turnaround in the mood the last two rounds.
Leo Cullen, thanks a million.
Leo Cullen yesterday helping to launch the 10-year anniversary of the 2009 Heineken Cup win, the gala dinner event. You can get more tickets, more details on the tickets at leinsterrugby.ie. That's pretty much all we've got time for on the this morning's show. It's been decent. If you missed it, you can get it all on YouTube. The Shot Clock with Kieran Donaghy, the full Leo Cullen interview, and Nathan having some difficulties with his Wi-Fi from Manchester in the aftermath of the City-West Ham game last night. You can also get it, of course, at offtheball.com, and you can subscribe to the AM podcast to check it all out if you just want to listen to this a little bit later on. I know a lot of people just do get this whole thing by podcast. Just before we do leave you, I do want to give a shout out to everybody taking part in the Turn Your Tiger Blitz this Sunday. It's the 3rd of March, and wish everybody there the best of luck. For the last 10 years, Leinster and the IRFU have been supporting the Disability Tag Rugby programme, which runs throughout the province. There's now 16 clubs which field disability rugby tag teams in Leinster, with many other clubs hoping to do the same in the future. The aim of the Tiger Blitz is to provide children and adults with either a learning or physical disability the opportunity to learn to play tag rugby, with all the massive benefits that that brings. And they've had a host of clubs confirm their attendance for this weekend. Carlow Bees, Kildare Foxes, De La Salle Eagles, Dunbrody Warriors, the Greystone Seagulls, the Navan Blue Dragons, the Seapoint Dragons, Terenure Tigers and Westmanstown Wasps. It's kicking off from 12:30 to 2:00 on both the main pitch and the 4G pitch in Lakelands in Terenure in Dublin. So best of luck to everybody involved in that. And if you're in the area and you have the chance to pop in and show your support, then please do get along. And who knows, there might even be some big names along on the day too. So if you've got any interest in that, or indeed you want to get involved in a tag team, then I'm sure you'll be able to get details of how to do that on Sunday as well. That's your lot today, Thursday Night Football with John Giles, the football show, and of course some rugby and GAA analysis coming your way from this evening at 7 on News Talk. The hurling show will be on our social channels a little bit later on this afternoon. Make sure you subscribe to all of them and we'll ping you with the details as soon as we're ready to go live. Good luck. So if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 AM.